Hello and welcome to the morning Bible study. It is 17th July 2020 and we are continuing through 2 Samuel. We are in 2 Samuel chapter 21. Well, why don't you go ahead and read 2 Samuel chapter 21 verses 1 through 14. Go ahead then and unpause your audio and we will dive right into the text. Okay, so this is just heads up. One of the most confusing passages in the entire Bible. I mean, one of the bang your head against your desk passages for pastors, because it is just so difficult to be able to effectively deal with this text in a way that is theologically consistent with what we know about the nature of God and with what we know about the nature of David and justice and, like, being a person. It's just a really difficult passage to be able to reckon with and wrestle with. So just know at the outset that if the things that I say, if the commentary that I offer and the explanations for the text that I provide are deeply unsatisfying to you, don't worry. They're deeply unsatisfying to me too. Okay? This is a difficult passage of the Bible. This is a problem passage. This is a place where there is just really not a good answer to what's going on. And it's just one of those places that we struggle with. Okay. So I'm assuming that you've read the text. So we're going to dive in. During David's reign, there was a famine for 3 consecutive years. Straightforward, to the point. Just during David's reign. So obviously this is not a logically or a chronologically consistent follow-up to the events that we've just had in chapter 20 and the previous chapters, dealing with the rebellion of Absalom, dealing with the rebellion of Sheba, son of Bichri, dealing with the fight against Shimei. This is just kind of out of the blue. Just, hey, during David's reign, there was a famine for 3 consecutive years. Huh, who would have thought? And David inquired of the Lord. And the Lord said, it is because of Saul in his blood-stained family, because he murdered the Gibeonites. Okay, wait a minute. We didn't know anything about this, right? This is just out of the blue. And the story comes up in the text out of the blue. Okay, so it's very interesting that we don't know anything about this. This is information that's been withheld. There's been no foreshadowing of this in the text up to this point. And now it comes in out of the blue as well. And I think part of that is because a couple reasons. One, we're now taking an episodic look at David's reign. We're looking just at high points, major events, and just kind of jumping through David's reign and looking at theologically significant things, or at least so it seems, right? It seems like Samuel has gone from having a definite and deliberate story arc, talking about how we're moving from the chaos of the period of the judges to the certitude and the strength of having a God-chosen king. That seems to be part of it. But remember, there's also another part of Samuel, and those are some of the themes and motifs that we have. The themes and motifs we have in Samuel are what? Well, God exalts the humble. He seats them on thrones of honor. He seats them with princes. And God brings down the proud. He humbles the mighty. Okay, so those are some themes and things we're looking at. So when we come up with a problem passage, when we come up with something that doesn't seem to fit, we have to ask broader questions of what is the author trying to accomplish? Because this now looks like a chronicle. Okay, 1st and 2nd Samuel are not chronicles. They're not chronicles of the king. Now, the Chronicles of the King are really, they are unique pieces of literature in their own right, and they have their own authorial purpose. They have their own reason for being, their own raison d'être, if you want to use the fancy French and, you know, sound like you got something stuck in your throat. Okay, they have their own purpose. That's not what 1st and 2nd Samuel are. The Samuel material is not a chronicle. It's not designed to be a chronicle. It's really not a biography either. It's a theological treatise on royalty and about godliness. Spoken of through the lens of humility and arrogance. I think that's what 1st and 2nd Samuel are. It's a theological treatise on rulership written through the lens of humility and arrogance. Okay? That's what it is. So that means it's not a chronicle. Judges is similar. Judges is like a chronicle in that it picks episodic events that are not logically connected with the other events. It simply gives us a chronology, a chronicle of events that are selected because of their theological significance. And now, chronicle doesn't necessarily have to have theological significance, but in the Bible, they do. In the Bible, the chronicles we have theological significance. It's selected material put in a chronological order as a chronicle that tells some kind of theological point. But the point of chronicles is they're episodic. There's no narrative arc. Well, if there is, it's narrative arc by choosing disconnected events. Samuel picks connected events. They're events that naturally lead one to the other. And so it's a narrative rather than a chronicle. But here we have this out of the blue event that seems almost like a chronicle, where we have just something taken out of the blue. It's random. It doesn't logically follow from the previous events. And so, we first of all, we know that structurally this is strange. We know that we haven't had foreshadowing to this. This is hearkening back to the days of Saul. And again, what do we see? The interesting thing is we see more trouble with the Benjamites. Okay, so that's maybe a connection, but it's very strange. And so the king summoned the Gibeonites, and he spoke with them. Now the Gibeonites were not descendants of Israel. They were a remnant of the Amorites. The Israelites had made a promise to them, but Saul tried to kill them because of his zeal for the people of Israel and Judah. Interesting that Israel and Judah are separated here at this point. Now remember, we talked at length about the Gibeonites in a Bible study. It's one of my favorite passages of the Bible. They were Amorites who deceived the Israelites. They pretended like they were from far away, and they made peace with the Israelites. And then after the Israelites had made peace with them, they learned that they were not from far away, and they ended up going to war. And that was the time when the sun stood still in the sky. It was big event, big major event in the book of Joshua. So the Gibeonites, where Joshua said that because you lied, you're going to be water carriers and woodcutters for the house of God. And they were like, yeah, sure, as long as we get to live. And they basically incorporated themselves into Israelite society. Saul apparently started killing them. Didn't know about this. Okay. And so David said to the Gibeonites, he says, what can I do for you? And how can I make amends so that you will bless the Lord's inheritance? Okay. So why is this happening now? Why is this happening now? I mean, it doesn't have to happen now. There's a famine. The famine is caused by God. And God says, Yahweh says, it is because of Saul and his bloodstained family, because he murdered the Gibeonites. Why now? I mean, Saul is decades ago. Well, I don't know. And so the Gibeonites say to him, we have no claim to silver or gold from Saul or his family, nor would we be justified in putting to death anyone in Israel. Okay, so basically what they're saying is, look, we can't claim money damages, and we don't have the power to put anybody to death. And David asked, well, what do you want me to do then? Like, if you don't want remuneration and you're not willing to put anybody to death, then what do you want me to do? And they said, as for this man who exterminated us and who schemed against us so that we were destroyed and left without status throughout all the borders of Israel, let seven of his male descendants be turned over to us, and we will execute them before Yahweh and Gibeah of Saul, who was Yahweh's chosen one. The king replied, I will turn them over. Wait, what? Hold on. Hold on just a cotton picking second here. The law of God says that a child shall not be put to death for the sins of his father. So what? The king had mercy on Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, in light of the Lord's oath that he had taken between David, that had been taken between David and Jonathan, son of Saul. And the king took Armoni and Mephibosheth, two sons of Aiah's daughter Rizpah, whom she had borne to Saul, and the five sons of Saul's daughter Merab, whom she had borne, by the way, David was supposed to marry Merab, whom she had borne to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Meholathite. He turned them over to the Gibeonites, and they executed them on a hill before the Lord. The seven of them died together. They were put to death during harvest time, during the first days of the beginning of the barley harvest. This smacks of paganism, right? Like, if you're not seeing at least partial connections to pagan human sacrifice, I don't think you're looking. Then Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it out for herself on a rock. From the beginning of the harvest until the rain fell on them, she did not allow the birds of the air to feed on them by day, nor the wild animals by night. When David was told what Rizpah, daughter of Aya, Saul's concubine, had done, he went and took the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan from the leaders of Jabesh-Gilead. They had secretly taken them from the plaza at Beth-Shan. It was there that the Philistines publicly exposed their corpses after they had killed Saul at Gilboa. David brought the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan from there. They also gathered up the bones of those who had been executed. Okay, so Rizpah, daughter of Aya, she's a descendant of Saul. This is a wife of Saul. A wife of Saul. What does she do? Her sons are dead. And she goes near her rotting children. I don't know if you've been around rotting corpses. They don't smell good, right? I'm sure everybody listening to me has been around a rotting corpse. Not a human corpse. I haven't been around a rotting human corpse. But, you know, livestock, animals that have been hunted, dead mice, you know, they smell really bad. And Rizpah goes out there, getting in the heat of the day, out in the harvest, and all she does is keep the birds and the wild animals away from her children. That's grotesque. I mean, I'm not bashing Rizpah. I'm just saying, like, this is pretty horrific. Because what else does the law of Israel say? It says that no one hung on a tree shall be left overnight, because that's cursing, and it would bring cursing on the land. So what do we do with this? So then they buried them, verse 14. They buried the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan in the land of Benjamin at Zelah in the grave of his father Kish. After they had done everything that the king had commanded, God responded to their prayers for the land. What? What is going on? What is going on? I have no clue how to respond to this. I have none. I do not know how to respond to what is going on in this text, because it is pure crazy town. I mean, it is pure crazy town. But what do you say about this? I mean, what do you say about this text? It is one of the most difficult passages in the Bible that I can even imagine to try to deal with. It is just, I don't really have words for how we should describe this. And really, the commentaries are no help. They're just not. All they do is add levels of confusion. I have not seen a solution that brings a lot of clarity. You know, some people are wanting to say David did right. Some people are saying David did wrong. We see that the famine actually ceases. And it's like, is God appeased? Is this, what do we do with this? What do we do with this? I really wish I had a clear answer, because there really isn't one. Dealing with this text, whatever way you go, whatever explanation you go with, you've got a counterfactual, right? Like, so if you say that David did right because Saul had broken the oath that was made with the Gibeonites. It was an eternal covenant, and Saul broke it, and somebody has to pay for the breaking of that covenant. Well, why should Saul's children and grandchildren pay for that? Why should Saul's descendants pay for it? They didn't break the oath. And it's like, but you know who else didn't break the oath? The children of the rebels in the desert. The children of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, they weren't guilty, and yet they were swallowed up alive. But see, the thing is that's God doing that. That's God in all of his wisdom doing that. This is David. And golly, is it so? But then if you say that, well, they shouldn't have done it, that David did wrong, but the famine stopped. I mean, it's an incredibly difficult passage that I don't know that there is a good answer for. I just don't know that there is. And I really wish right now that I could just give you an easy solution, but I don't have one. I don't have an easy solution. I think that I think that what we are forced to confront here is that David had an opportunity here to bring peace. He had an opportunity to do one of two things. David could have came to the Gibeonites and said, look, the man who harmed you is dead, and God has punished him, and can we make sacrifices on your behalf so that this doesn't end in more bloodshed and more bitterness? David could have brought arbitration. David could have brought peace, but instead he said, you know, blood calls for blood. And so we see these moral dilemmas often in the Bible, and we see people, I think, making wrong choices. I think David did the wrong thing. I think David did the wrong thing here. Now, you say, but the famine ceased. It did. It did. The famine did cease because the blood was avenged to the Gibeonites' satisfaction. Apparently, the Gibeonites had been cursing Israel because of this, because they had broken their oath. They were oath breakers, and God accepts this act of essentially murder to satiate the bloodlust of the Gibeonites, their search for revenge, and God accepts this as satisfaction, and you know the famine ceases. That's where we are, friends. It is a hard, hard passage. Now, here's where we don't go, okay? So if you are a Christian, here's what you don't say. You don't say, well, God was wrong. You don't say that. That's not an acceptable answer. That's not a solution to the problem. God wasn't wrong. God is never wrong. But just because we know that God isn't wrong doesn't mean that we don't know how God is right. I think that what happens here is that God... Basically, in this event, God allowed people to do things their way. God allowed people to do things their way. And he told David, he's like, hey, Israel broke faith. They broke their oath, and that is why this famine is coming. And so David tries to solve the problem, and how does he solve it? By giving in to the baser, immoral, and unlawful desires of the Gibeonites. He gives in to them. And God accepts that. God accepts his decision and says, hey, look, Israel's happy. Gibeon's happy. I'm going to let this go. But I don't think that means God gives his moral approval to it either. Just because God allows something to happen and God allows people to go along their merry way doesn't necessarily mean that God approves of it. I think that the claim for blood vengeance was dropped by the Gibeonites. And so God, being a fair actor, said, look, the people cursing you have stopped cursing you. They're now blessing you. And so I'm going to respond to that. I'm going to respect that. This is up to you guys to solve this. I think that this is what happens. This is what we see when David seeks the wisdom of Gibeon rather than asking God, what should I do? Notice he doesn't say, ask God what he should do. Look at the text. Look carefully here. He says to God, he says, you know, he says, what's going on? And God says, it is because of Saul and his bloodstained family, because he murdered the Gibeonites. So the king summoned the Gibeonites and spoke with them. He didn't ask God. He didn't ask Yahweh what to do. He asked Gibeon what to do. And I think that this is what happens. God lets the world go, friends. God takes his hand off. You read Romans, The wrath of God is revealed by what? By God sending thunder and lightning? By him fulminating from the heavens? No, by him letting us go and do things our own way. We've got this story. Then we have what story follows this? Battles with the Philistines. And then what do we see more of? We see this random song from David, which is a pretty awesome song, by the way. We see David's final words. We see David's warriors. We see David taking the census. We see David building the temple. And then we're done with the Samuel material. It becomes extremely episodic towards the end. The structure has changed with this. After the end of the last revolt, the structure changes, and it really follows a a Judges type pattern. Remember how Judges follows generally a chronology? And it's episodic, yes. But then at the end, we break the chronology and we just look at random events that are indicative of the spiritual condition of the nation at the time that the book concludes. We see the same thing in 2 Samuel. We pick these episodic events that are out of chronology, out of order, to give us an instance of the overall status of the kingdom. And it's very strange. It is very strange. I think that what we see here, and again, I could be wrong, but I think that what we see here, and I'm repeating myself to make sure that we get this across, what we see is the result of what happens when people stop inquiring of God and start doing things their own way, and God lets them go. What do we see? We see murder. God says, you make your own rules. I'll let you make your own rules. And what do we see? We see murder. We see the devastation of a woman, and we see blood vengeance that breaks the laws of Israel, that breaks God's express commands. So, and then what follows that? Battle between the Philistines and Israel. It is very strange. It is very strange. I would love to say that I knew more about this. We'll probably cover this last bit of material here next week before we get into the Kings. But it is, friends, if you can make sense of all this, you are wiser than me, because it is difficult material. But anyways, don't murder people. That's our big theological conclusion for today. Don't murder people. Anyways, thank you. And if we do not have Bible studies right away next week, it is because my wife just had our fourth baby. Hooray, that's coming. So if you don't hear from me Monday, it is because I am either with my wife giving birth, or I am with my family as we are enjoying our newest breathing baby. Anyways, I thank you for your time. May God richly bless you. Goodbye.